You're listening to the Fat Dude Digs Flicks Movie Podcast Network. And now, the Criterion Break. Greetings and salutations, everyone, and welcome to an all-new episode of the Criterion Break. I am one-third of your hosting trifecta, Andy, the resident fat dude of Fat Dude Digs Flicks. If this is your first time listening to the Criterion Break, this is a podcast where three friends get together to chat about their love for the Criterion Collection proper and the Criterion Channel. Now, I said three friends and a trifecta, so that means who are the two other co-hosts? As always, I am joined by the lovely Derek Varink. Derek, how you doing, buddy?
Good. You call me lovely. I am disoriented right off the bat, but thank you.
I'm gonna go back to like the adjective thing where I just kind of come up with random adjectives for my introduction. So you Swirl. Get lovely, and then we're also joined by the vivacious Blake Ginnethan. Blake, how you doing?
Doing good. I was hoping for salty tonight, but that's okay.
I'll have to hold on to that one. I'll keep salty when I know that your opinions are going to be a little tough. So
okay, yeah.
Well, as I said, we are the three hosts of the Criterion Break, where we get a chance to kind of chat about our love of the Criterion Collection. We are actually starting today our director's miniseries on the films of Wong Kar-wai. This is something we've all been very excited for, so we are going to start digging into those films today. But before we get into that, we're going to kind of go through some movies that are Criterion related that we have been watching. And the sole speaker during this section this week is Mr. Blake Ginnethan. So Blake, what have you been watching?
Yeah, I saw one movie, and that's I don't think it's in the collection yet, but I watched Triangle of Sadness.
Oh, sure,
The new Ruben Östlund movie. I think it's coming soon, but
yes, April.
Yeah. Oh, so very soon. Okay. So yeah, I didn't get this screened at the State Theater. Back in like September or October, November. Okay. And I didn't get a chance to go to it. Honestly, mainly because I kind of didn't have any interest in it. Yeah. But once it kind of got the Oscar nominations, I was like, okay, well, I need to see what the hype is about. And I finally get to watch it. And, this is my second Östlund. I've not seen The Square, but I have seen Force Majeure. This is by far my favorite thing that he's done. I loved this movie a lot. The one thing I kept thinking about when I was watching this was that this just felt like a great melding of Hollywood filmmaking with European filmmaking. Like it felt like a great bonding of the two. I loved the how like Östlund was like sort of playing with these ideas. It gets a little like, maybe a little too heavy-handed at times, and it's a little like, I would say it's about 20 minutes too long. The final sequence, I think the point was made very soon into the final hour of the movie, but I really loved it. I think it's one of the best movies of 2022, and I don't think it's going to win anything at the Oscars, but it's still pretty cool that people kind of like drank the Kool-Aid on this one. I really liked it a lot. So,
yeah, I think Derek and I had both seen this one. I can't remember if you had seen it previously before our viewing at the State, Derek, or maybe I'm mixing that up with something else.
You and I both saw it at different showings at the State.
Oh, sure. Theater. That's right. And we both were kind of positive, but more lukewarm, if I recall correctly. It's been one that has stuck with me though, and it's one that I wanted to revisit. So I even thought about buying the digital copy of it. But I think once Criterion announced that they were going to release the special edition of it, I was kind of like, I'll just wait and then I'll rewatch it then. But I remember that there were parts of it that I really enjoyed. But I think that heavy-handed that you said that heavy-handedness, I think that is something that's totally true because it especially in the middle for me, it kind of got weighed down by its own, like, this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna have this conversation. Look at us philosophizing. And it just got a little too bulky. But I loved the beginning and I loved like the first section of everything before they get to the ship and all the stuff early on the ship. And then all of the stuff when they got to the island, which was just kind of crazy. I want to talk about the ending a little bit, which will be spoilers. So if you have not seen Triangle of Sadness, give yourself maybe a 5 minute break here, and we'll be back to regular stuff here in a minute. But I wanted to say about Triangle of Sadness. So for your guys' opinion of how this movie ends, she kills her, right? Like that's what we're supposed to imply. Or is it more of like, does she kill her? What do you get out of that ending of the film?
Me or
Both of you, either whoever wants to take it.
I guess for me, like she kills her, right? I mean,
Yeah.
I think, she says something to the effect of like, we work really well together. You can be my assistant. And I think for her, I forget the character's name, but like she just knows that like she'll take that, and then very quickly the power structure, the class structure will soon come back into place, and
Can't have that.
yeah, you can't have that. Also, it could be what's her name's way of doing her best to survive. So she could have just been saying that because the other woman was clearly running the roost on the island. So
But Derek, what were your thoughts on I maybe on the movie in general and the ending?
I mean I've been pretty upfront that I feel the movie is quite overlong. And I was pretty much fine with the movie all the way through, the big, shipwreck, vomiting, etc. set piece. I was all cool with that. You're absolutely right that, the final hour or so is, did it need to be an hour? We kind of got the point across. We kind of know where it's, once it settles into the new power structure slash hierarchy that, we're kind of settled in there for a while. And I was of the impression too that, yeah, the Shelby Dean character does kill the Dolly De Leon character, frankly, because this is a movie that's willing to push those boundaries, and I can't see it whimpering out like that if it was any other ending or approach. So that's how I saw it.
I think that's the I guess, well, for lack of a better term, the final nail in the coffin as to what's been going on throughout this whole movie of like the rich are now finally kind of the ones who are at the beck and call of the person who has been serving everyone this entire throughout this entire cruise, taking care of cleaning things. And I just think that's I think it's a really I think it's a really interesting movie, and I think it's one that I would agree with you. I have not been super in love with Ostlund's over other movies. I like them just fine, but I would say that this one is the one that I've kind of feel more connected to because it feels like he's playing at his full powers here. Just everything that he's tried to do before, he kind of is at his most clear here and defined, and I really like that. I do also feel that Dolly De Leon, I don't know who you would take out of the supporting actress category to put her in, but I really would have liked to have seen her get a nomination for this movie because I thought she was great to watch.
See, I didn't buy the hype on that.
Oh, okay.
I watched the movie and I was generally perplexed why people thought she was good. But that's
Interesting.
just me. Yeah.
Sure.
Because I had heard the hype and I was like, oh, okay. But I didn't see anything. I don't know. Maybe it's because it's not like a showy performance. You know, it's yeah. just it's just a very strong, you know, woman in the movie who sort of like, you know, it's very like the like I feel like the last like hour of the movie, the way like it sort of makes you feel is like it's based around this one woman's like not destructive force, but like just her authority over everybody.
Yeah, and I'd also say, I mean, you know, the first two acts of the movie, you know, she's, you know, I can also see it as well because, you know, her character intentionally, you could say, is very much shunted aside, you know,
yeah.
you know, obviously being treated lowly. And then it's only in that third act when she yeah. comes through and you're kind of almost like, oh, when are we going to get to the fireworks factory?
Yeah, that might have been it. I have to say, to piggyback off your comment about how, like, Ocelyn's working with all his powers. The sequence of the movie, which everyone is, I'm sure, talking about or is going to talk about when they see the movie, is when, you know, everyone's throwing up at this dinner. Like, the way that whole scene is sort of like the how, like, the match is lit and then it's, like, slowly building to this crescendo of, like, you know, violence. Like, that whole sequence is so well made, you know, to the sound effects, to the comedy bits. Like, there's a, you know, for people who don't know, like, there's a whole sequence where, like, the ship hits bad weather and everyone's at this dinner and they start throwing up and it just keeps going on and going on. And there's just so many, like, really funny visual gags that keep the sequence going. It has to be 15 minutes of the movie, maybe 20 minutes of the movie. But, like, you know, there's one sequence where, like, this guy, like, is outside wiping puke off a window while the ship is, you know, like, being attacked by weather. And like, there's a woman who's in her, like, underwear going, like, rocking back and forth in her bathroom in her own vomit and diarrhea. Like, it's so well done, you know? Yeah. And I have to say, like, I wonder if people saw that and were like, yeah, best director nomination for sure. So, but it's really cool to see Ocelyn sort of like hit the big time with this, because, like, while, like, Andy and I said, like, we're both not in love with his work, like, he is an interesting director to watch, and I'm really curious to see where he goes next. I was talking to Derek about this after I watched it. Like, I'm a big sucker for ambiguous endings with, like, really cool pop music, and so this movie ends with just like the most, like, esoteric final shot of the movie. And, like, it's all like, oh, this is really, like, happy going, but not. And, like, I love stuff like that. So
yes.
Triangle of Sadness really worked for Blake Ginnethan. So
awesome. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to giving this another watch. And I think it will be one that I pick up during some Criterion sale to add to my collection.
Very cool cover art for that.
Yeah.
Criterion collection.
Yeah, good call on that. Good choice. So, any other movies that you guys have seen recently? This doesn't even have to be Criterion related, but any other movies that you guys want to discuss before we dive into our Wong Kar-wai series?
Do we want to talk about All Quiet on the Western Front, or should we save that for a different episode?
You know,
I just feel like all three of us loved that movie, and I know we're kind of like we're talking about a possible Oscars show, so I don't know if you want to save it for that.
Let's do that. Let's save
okay.
it.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, then we can kind of gather our thoughts. Because
sure.
Yeah, I think you do. You speak for all of us on that. Because, man, what a great movie. And I look forward to talking more about that as we once we do that Oscar episode.
Yeah.
So
I did want to throw out there just. We haven't done this in a while, but I do want to throw it out because these just happened. Did anybody want to comment on anything related to the May announcements that just came out?
Yeah, it's a great month. Let me pull it up here. Or do you have them already pulled up?
I've got it. So it's Wings of Desire in 4K.
Yeah.
Branded to Kill in 4K. Mm-hmm. Peter Bogdanovich's Targets, Petite Maman, and Thelma and Louise in 4K.
Yeah. This is 4K
as well? Holy cow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a great release month. This is gonna probably not shock anybody that knows my taste in movies. I don't love Wings of Desire, but I definitely think that's one that will benefit from a good 4K transfer. And it's something I feel like I need to watch again too. It just didn't hit me the first time. There was a joke on the internet where somebody said, "Finally coming to 4K from the Criterion Collection, Wings of Desire," and it was the poster of City of Angels. And I was like, "I'd buy that. I'd buy that." But the other ones, I haven't seen. Was it Branded for Life? Is that what it's called?
Branded to Kill.
Branded to Kill. I own it, but guess what? Haven't watched it yet. But the other three, I am very excited to get those. Targets is one that's been on my watch list for a very long time. I saw like 10 minutes of it on like AMC or Turner Movie Classics one day and was like, "What? Why is Boris Karloff like in the crosshairs here? What's going on?"
What?
And I didn't want to watch it to the end because I didn't want to ruin it, but then I couldn't find the movie. So
what, which one is Targets? Is that the like drive-in shooting thing?
I think so. I think it does take place, but I know the scene that I saw, I remember like he was walking through like a city. There were a lot of buildings around and he was in the crosshairs. So,
See I always get that movie mixed up with 2 Minute Warning, which is another movie about a guy with a rifle at a, you know, killing people. But I think that one is at a football game, which makes sense with the title, but I think that's the one I've seen, which is a wild movie, but, yeah, interesting. I love Bogdanovich. I've only seen a couple of movies, but like that dude, he makes great movies. So I'm really excited for Targets. I, like I said in our group chat, I just really want They All Laughed to be in the collection, maybe because I brought it up in the in our Criterion wish list a year or so ago. But it's super cool. I'm excited to see if like The Last Picture Show. Actually, that's already in the Criterion Collection.
It is,
yeah.
But if something like
Paper Moon would be it.
Yeah. Paper Moon. Yeah, that's the one. Oh, that's a great movie. So
I did not realize until right now, looking through his filmography, that he was the director of Mask. I don't know why that didn't click in for me, but I will perpetually have a soft spot in my heart for Mask. I think that one's a great, great 80s tearjerker. So, great filmography for Bogdanovich. I have What's Up, Doc on my future to record episodes of Let's Talk About. So, holding up on watching that until I get that episode scheduled. So,
very cool.
But then, of course, another one of our favorites from last year. I believe, Derek, you enjoyed this one too. Petite Maman from Celine Sciamma. Man, what a great little movie. So good. So heartwarming. I wish, just kind of looking over their list of features, I wish they would include more. Because it is such a short movie, and you know, I would like a little bit of extra to go with it, but hopefully that interview is or that conversation is long, so you get a nice little bang for your buck for that Criterion Collection. But a great cover.
I don't like the cover. I was just gonna say, I love, there's a poster, I don't know what country it's from, but where they're like, it's an up close intimate shot of them hugging.
I thought
that would be like the perfect cover art, but I get it. You know, I get it.
So, And then I'll just say really quickly, Thelma and Louise. Hell yeah. I love Thelma and Louise.
Is this the first Ridley Scott in the collection?
Correct.
Yeah.
Wow.
Of either Scott brother, I believe.
Wow.
Well, hopefully this opens the door to Prometheus at some point. So.
Yep, that's the one we're waiting for. I think this is I love the cover. You know, I said that I like the cover for
Petite
Maman. I love this cover for Thelma and Louise. Super cool. Just a lot, like, looks like it's loaded with features. Probably some of them have been carried over from other releases, but I think the 4K transfer is totally going to be super exciting. I feel like I can say that now because I have a TV that handles 4K a lot better. So super cool. Any other thoughts, you guys? I feel like I was kind of holding over that conversation. You guys brought it up. You should talk about it.
I don't have much to say.
I mean, it's a strong month overall, and you know, a lot of titles that certainly perked our collective ears up. So I at least wanted to give a little moment for that.
Yeah, nice. It's a fun month. It's fun to kind of have a month where there are those like quite a, like, Thelma and Louise for me is a tentpole release. Like, that's a big deal. These other movies are, you know, really, really interesting, smaller movies, but I think ones that'll leave an impact. So, yeah, good month. Good month. Well, guys, let's dive into our featured movie of this episode, our featured pair of movies for this episode. We're breaking through on our coverage of the film collection of Wong Kar-wai, starting with his first two films. As tears go by, goodness gracious, I keep wanting to call it As Years Go By, and I have to stop myself. As Tears Go By and Days of Being Wild. Let's start with As Tears Go By, because that's the feature film debut. Oh, go ahead.
Well, first off, I think we should call out Blake chose Wong Kar-wai as a director, so I at least wanted to give him a few minutes to speak on you know why he chose him and you know all that jazz.
Yes, I should start taking notes so that I know what I want to, how I want to do this. But yeah, Blake, you definitely deserve the floor on this. So why the films of Wong Kar-wai?
How do I say this? So years ago, I discovered that there's like a weird comfort I get in being in like in misery. And in the way of like, sometimes when we're looking for love or looking for a connection, that sometimes the thought of or the search of is the most like pleasant part of that. I know this all sounds super weird, but to me, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And like, I've always sort of like a music sort of did that for me, where you listen to, you know, certain crooners or musicians sing about like, just like finding love or like losing love. And it's sort of like, there's something very like melancholy about that, but also I love living in that realm. And it wasn't until I saw Chungking Express maybe, I don't know, 16, 17 years ago, where like I finally got like the person who perfectly encapsulated that feeling. And to a certain extent, like audio as well. And so it's for me like Wong Kar-wai is the guy who understands like what it like he's just found this ability, whether it's with his characters or also like the way he films stuff, just to like get into these people's heads about like how they like yearn for people, learn for like human connection, yearn for love. And it's more about like them yearning for it as opposed to like them having it, if that makes any sense. And it's just, I don't know, like there's something about his movies that really just like, I almost can't put it into words what his movies mean to me, because like it's just like my heart like flutters when I watch his movies, because he just, the spaces he captures, the people he has on screen, the way he moves his cameras, the way he edits, the needle drops he has, they all just like, they give me the sense of like, oh, somebody else understands how I feel. Mm-hmm. And I don't, I you know, like Quentin Tarantino is probably my favorite filmmaker, and so is Scorsese and Spielberg, but like Wong Kar-wai is the one who like, is like, if you want to understand me, like he's the skeleton key. He's like the Rosetta Stone of like who I am personally. And so, you know, I was sort of worried that like Chungking Express would be it as far as like, I was worried that like outside of that, he wouldn't offer much more. And I'm glad to say that like, I was wrong about that, because so far I've now seen every movie in this world of Wong Kar-wai set. And I'm just happy to say like most of that, it really hits me. So, that's what it means to me. That's what he means to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great. Like, I think that, the sentiment of, that longing and yearning, I think is really what definitely permeates through his movies. And it's, I think certainly apparent in one of these movies that we watched, and I feel like we could probably talk about it in the other one, which would be the first one, As Tears Go By. Derek, I'm going to start with you for initial thoughts on this. What were your instant takeaways from watching as tears go by? God, every time as tears just go by,
just think of crying. Just think of crying.
I know.
This movie. Watching these two movies for this episode, this is my first exposure to Wong Kar-wai. And so taking the chronological approach, I think is going to be very fascinating here, because this is very much a quote unquote first film, yeah. In that you can kind of very much see, like, you know, like here's the movies, like he's trying to, you know, emulate or, you know, kind of go along with like the popular trend. We'll get into that in our discussion, I'm sure. But then you see moments here, especially amid movie passage in this, where you kind of see, you know, that swooning romantic vibe, mm-hmm. that he's known for come through in full blast. And it's very fascinating to see him use kind of this, you know, like crime movie structured to kind of work in and smuggle in, you know, these greater ideas that he almost certainly wants to play with, and which he certainly realizes with in his next movie. And, you know, I think obviously, even though there's kind of like that tug of war between, you know, more of the genre stuff versus the romance, I think it's all very endearing and it works as a good mix. And, you know, it's certainly a, you know, more of like a general pop culture piece, you know, which is why I know like Andy was a little bit more lesser to it, because it's more of like a typical structure in terms of like, okay, here's your character archetypes, and yep, some of these go in kind of obvious directions. But I think overall the energy and the style of it helps to make it a pretty filling meal. Not perfect, of course, you know, yeah. Definitely not original, but certainly still worth viewing.
Yeah, definitely. Blake, your thoughts?
Yeah, I had heard that like before watching as Tears Go By, I had heard that it if you're a Wong Kar-wai fan, like it's not like his typical movies, so you're not gonna like it. Mm-hmm. But like I sort of loved it. I sort of love that, like as Derek said, it's a first movie. But you can still see that, like, his stamp is on this movie. You know, like, his infamous step printing editing method is like front and center in some of the action pieces here. Like, there's so many incredible shots of like people kind of like being really moody in like really dark atmospheric settings, and just like a lot of shots where you could just like freeze the movie and like take a picture of that frame, and that could be a picture, you know, like his. So you guys are going to find out that he loves to needle drop like cover songs of famous songs. And like, mm-hmm. he does that right away in this movie, not right away, but like in this first movie. So like, it's just really cool to see him get to stamp his sort of like style on this movie pretty much immediately.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that's the thing that really stood out to me, because I think thematically, this one feels disconnected from what I, like, in quotation fingers, think is a Wong Kar-wai movie.
Yeah.
But it still has his, like,
yeah.
the roots of his trademark visual sense.
Yeah.
And I think the way that he, like, he connects these characters together, I think that's all, it's all still there, and it's kind of fun to watch, you know, that this was the first building block to really put that together.
Yeah,
you know, because it gets, you know, it gets much much more advanced from here. But I did enjoy this movie. I think my only problem with it is that it felt really rushed towards the ending, that it was just like, all right, we've gotta get to the end here with these characters.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, we've been living this life of crime throughout the whole thing, and they've gone through ups and downs, and they've been okay through those, but now it's time for them to pay. And it just felt very abrupt. But there's that sequence in there where it's like, oh gosh, now I gotta remember. He goes into, like,
yeah,
it yes. goes into the club, and it's like it might even be the first time where the one guy goes into the club and it just like starts causing trouble. He doesn't, you know, he gets hurt on his way out, but it's just like the audacity of going into this, you know, this pit
yeah.
where people are instantly against you and you know that you are going to have to fight your way out. It's just thrilling. And it feels like a Hong Kong action movie.
Yeah. I was going to say, so like one thing to keep in mind is like this comes out at like the height of John Woo and Chow Yun Fat shooting everybody in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And so like, I don't know if this was a director for hire movie or what, but like, I'm guessing this got, you know, like, approved to make because like it was in the vein of all those like Choi Hark movies and Jackie Chan movies and things like that. So
yeah. And I think once you kind of like get in the mind frame that you're going to be watching a crime movie more than a Wong Kar Wai movie, you can really get on its wavelength and go with it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I thought this was really fun. It's always fun to go back and watch a director's early projects, like after you experience them kind of at a later point in their career. And it's, I would imagine it's kind of fun from Derek's point of view to go through this chronologically and kind of experience the growth, like from movie to movie to movie. So we'll kind of see if he grows on you even more, Derek, as we go along. Yeah. Do you want to kind of break this down, plot wise to kind of discuss it as we go, like we usually do?
Sure. So this movie starts off, we're introduced to Andy Lau's character. His name is Hua. He's kind of like this mid-level mob enforcer, who's going around, you know, getting people to pay up, you know, for whatever their, you know, debts or payoffs are. We don't get to that right away. We spend this little opening section where he's at home, he's in bed. He gets a call from his aunt saying, oh, by the way, your cousin is coming over. She has to go, you know, to the doctor for like a medical procedure with her lungs, and she's going to stay with you. And then almost as soon as the conversation ends, knock at the door. It's Maggie Cheung, properly masked because of her lungs, playing Noor. Again, she's his cousin, but she's going to be staying with him for a while she works or goes into the doctors. After that, we then get in more to his crime spiel because it's basically him and then his buddy Fly, played by Jackie Chung, who's right from the get-go, he's this wild card, hothead type of person, the kind of guy who from the jump, you know, he's going to make life difficult for Hua, you know, and Hua's often going to be the one who kind of fixes it, bails him out, etc., and so forth. And we get that a lot through this. Mm-hmm. Let me see here. I'm going through here. Hua gets dumped by his girlfriend, who had an abortion with his child. Hua gets pissed off, gets drunk, comes home, takes it out on his cousin Noor, but then apologizes in the morning. We then have a set piece where Fly is at a snooker club, making a very, very ridiculous bet that there's no way he's going to get out of. And when shit goes down, he bails, but then gets severely beaten up, and Fly ultimately crashes at Hua's apartment while Noor is there. And at that point in time, Noor, who's hasn't really been well versed into what her cousin is up to, starts getting a little suspicious. And so after that little incident where they fix Fly up, she bails. I think I'll pause there just to start.
I think that's a good place to kind of stop for now, because it really sets the table with all of our characters. I always feel like it's fun in these crime movies to have the level-headed guy and then to have the hot-headed guy. Because like they're best friends, they're the guys that work together, and one way or another, you know that there's going to be some kind of conflict there, be it between them or because their bond is going to like rub up against somebody else in power, and it's going to really push the movie for push the movie into treacherous territory. And I think that's I like when the movies do that. It's not, you know, it's a trope. It's something that's done quite frequently, but sometimes when it's done well, it doesn't make it any less enjoyable. And then of course we're introduced to Noor, who is we're gonna say this a lot, played by the incredible Maggie Cheung. Just Wong Kar-wai knows how to film her in the most exquisite of ways. Like, she just, I don't know, she radiates off the screen. And that's all I'm going to say right now. But it's just great to get an introduction to her character, because it's this person who's kind of thrown into this world that she has no part in, no knowledge of, and just doesn't really know how to react. And I think it's a, you know, it's like we've said before, this movie's not doing anything super original, but it's still doing it in an interesting way. Any of you guys have any thoughts on the first part of the movie? Anything you want to add in there?
Nope.
Yeah. I'll talk. I mean, you've got three very distinct performances here, because, you know, Tony, you know, he's obviously got to be the cool guy, you know, the suave guy. Jackie Cheung is just going off the rails in every single moment he's in the movie. You know, again, in a lot of crime movies, you have, you know, the hothead who's going to cause trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's a very broad, you know, a very broad performance because of it, but you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and we will get there. And Maggie Cheung, you know, even up to this point, you know, she's obviously not a focal point of the movie. You can very well argue that this is largely still very much oriented on the crime side, you know, but when she does get to peek through here, you know, it is magnetic, and ultimately there will be a nice long passage in the movie where the movie is at full tilt romance, but we'll get there.
Yeah. Blake, any other thoughts that we haven't covered before we move on with the rest of the movie?
No, I just want to echo the Maggie Cheung sentiment. I just think, like, one thing I love about, you know, getting into Criterion is how they just understand, like, and they are so good at, like, showing why or who these other, like, movie stars of world cinema are. I know I said something similar when we watched a Catherine Deneuve movie where I was like, oh, my gosh, like, this is a freaking – she's a movie star, you know, like same thing with, is it Liv Ullmann? Like, just like, you know, movie star. Maggie Cheung's the same way, you know, like she's, and you know, we'll get to Tony Leung at the next episode, but, just like, yeah, she's just like, she just has this power to her, this like magneticism to her that, you know, is unmatched. So really loved her in this movie.
Yeah, I want to detour for just a second on that thought of yours, because it is really cool to kind of see, like, you know, you go to the movie theater now and you're exposed to all of these American stars who we're very, very familiar with. But it's really cool that Criterion like emphasizes on their site and their collection kind of work of all of these people who have really may not be well-known names here, but in their country where these movies were created, they are massive stars. I always think of Toshirô Mifune, big deal. Like, people know him, but it's like getting to see his work showcased in this collection is just excellent. Great to see these all of the names that we're going to end up seeing through this Wong Kar-wai series, Maggie Cheung especially. But all right, Derek, let's keep this train moving. What happens next?
All right. So as we said last time, Fly is in massive debt to another gangster. His name is Tony. So we get this very exciting sequence where Wah goes into Tony's business to get it settled. Tony makes it very clear that you know, Fly is only still alive because of his connection to Wah. Again, the whole thing of Wah continuing to bail Fly out. And so Tony makes it clear, you know, to Wah, you got to find the money. And so we get this wild sequence where he goes downstairs to, you know, the business part of the building and sticks up the owner for the money. And it's kind of wild how that plays out. Ultimately, he goes up to the godfather, mob boss, etc., to figure things out. And basically part of that is that Fly gets pushed out of any mob or crime work and ends up becoming the owner or the person running this fishballs cart in the street, where he gets mocked as such for now being a fishballs guy instead of, you know, a crime accomplice, etc. Let's see here. This is where we get into the big romantic section of the movie, because we mentioned earlier, Wah just got dumped by his girlfriend at the beginning of the movie, and now his ex-girlfriend is now married again. So Wah decides to go and travel to, well, let's see here, Kowloon, to see Nor for the day. And so they kind of like this, dare I say, like before sunrise type of, like, you know, hours together or whatever. However, she is now seeing her doctor. But they ultimately have a lot of time together. This is where we get the big lengthy sequence where we have this local cover of Berlin's Take My Breath Away. Only a couple years after Top Gun itself had come out. So again, this is very hip and fresh. And, you know, again, with the relevance of Maverick, I was certainly very excited and pleased, like, to the point where I was texting Blake, like, Blake, you are not ready for this needle drop. You're going to be very enthused. Just enjoy it, you know. And, you know, Blake ultimately has said his piece about, you know, how, you know, this is how Wong Kar Wai works. You know, this is where it happens. And of course, this is basically the first grand example of that. So I'll stop there so we can discuss that part.
Yeah, I would almost argue, and maybe it's because the last time I rewatched the original Top Gun, it felt like that song just keeps going and going and going and going. I would say that the use of Take My Breath Away here,
say it,
much more
say
effective.
Yeah,
much more effective.
I agree.
I was like, they know they're hitting the high points. They're playing the song. They're getting everything they need to do. This is great. Like, I am on board for this use of Take My Breath Away.
So
it comes in, leaves its impact and moves on. I like it.
So while we're on this topic here, I said something in my review about this movie. Are Tony Scott and Wong Kar Wai separated at birth?
I
sincerely think that these guys influence each other. I watch stuff like the Top Gun, where they make love sequence to this. Like, it's a Wong Kar Wai movie, and I think, like, stuff in, like, Revenge and True Romance is, like, lifted from other, like, Wong Kar movies. So I just wonder, and I have no proof of this at all. I really feel like these guys were, like, heavily influenced by each other.
Who used that technique first between the two of them? Because I
Which
feel
technique?
Like I don't know what it's called, but you always say it so eloquently. Like the stop printing? Filming?
Step printing.
Yeah, step printing.
Well, because I don't know who used it first, but Wong Kar Wai was the one who popularized it. He was the one that that sort of, like, brought that effect into mainstream. So.
Yeah. And then I feel like Tony Scott saw it and was like, yeah, I like that. I'm gonna do that too. But yeah, I just think it's great. Yeah. I just think this sequence of the movie, I think the use of that song is great. And I think the style there, definitely the two directors mirror each other.
I have to say, it's also really cool that, like, a character puts a coin into a machine and we watch the 45 drop down and the needle literally drops.
Yeah.
Like it's literally a needle drop in this movie, and I think that's just like I think that just speaks to who Wong Kar Wai is. Like if you watch him in interviews, he wears sunglasses indoors. Like the guy like is cool. The guy is the epitome of cool, and he's kind of like he's like a guy who wears his heart in his sleeve. You know, like that's what you get on screen. It's this guy who's in love with everything about his own movies.
Yeah, and I think it's cool. And when they're this good, I think he should be in love with his movies. Yeah. Derek, any other commentary on this section for you?
No, I mean, again, I kind of spelled it out in my summary in terms of, you know, this is the point where I get to see like, okay, this is, you know, again, I've only seen the one movie here, but it's very clear that this Take My Breath Away passage is much more indicative of the stuff that he wants to do, or at least, you know, take, you know, pause the whole crime narrative and just have these, you know, shots of love and longing set to the 6 or 7 minute tune and just luxuriate in it. And that, you know, is pretty significant to me. And of course, you know, it's something that would be confirmed when I watched the second movie in today's double feature that, okay, this is more of where, you know, he's trying, you know, where he wants to steer things. And this is going to be more indicative of the vibe I'm going to see in the rest of this series. So that was pretty evident to me right away, just seeing that one scene.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's keep moving. Let's get to the climax and ending of this motion picture.
All right. So Mr. Fishballs Fly is working his cart, and Tony, the guy who he's in debt to, comes around with his other guys, and they basically mock him for being Mr. Fishball Guy. So Fly gets his revenge by just beating up and wrecking and punching out the windows in Tony's car. Of course, Tony catches wind of this, and they pretty much beat the shit out of him, nearly killing him in the process. And so while Tony is with Nora, he gets a call saying, you need to pay for, you know, pay us to get your friend back. And so he has to leave Noor and head back. Hua threatens Tony once he gets back. Tony, of course, lets Fly go. Hua basically tells Fly, you know, get out of here, go back to your family, you know, just get out of here because you basically have no further shot in this. But of course, Fly, in true hothead fashion, isn't going to listen to Hua's advice. Once again, they are attacked by Tony. They're beaten. Fly basically breaks up, quote unquote, with Hua because, again, Hua just keeps getting him into trouble. And Hua goes back to Noor. Conveniently, because Noor is dating her doctor can fix him up conveniently. And of course they share more time together for that. And then we kind of get this quote unquote final job of the movie where the big mob boss gives Tony this assassination job to kind of make things right. You know, even though there's a very good chance that he will not survive this gig. However, Fly ends up taking the job. He's basically about to carry out this assassination. Hua gets there just in time. Fly attempts to perform the assassination, but it fails. Instead, Fly is shot. Hua grabs Fly's gun. It does pull off the assassination, but of course, Hua is also gunned down in the process. And as Hua is dying, he flashes back to his time with Noor and credits.
Yeah. The tragedy. it ends in tragedy. Blake, what were your thoughts of the last section of this film when it all kind of everything comes to a head?
Yeah, so, you know, with these types of movies, you always know that like the one hothead is going to get it ruined for the guy we really care about. And yeah, sure as shit that happens. And it's sort of a sad ending, but at the same time, like you feel like that it was inevitable and it kind of needs to end that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. Derek, were you going to say something?
I mean, it's basically it. I mean, again, from the moment you see, oh, he's got a hothead friend, and
yeah.
said hothead is making things trouble, you kind of know where it's going to go down, because obviously the hothead is the one that's going to create all the conflict and the getting in trouble that's going to make for it, you know. And of course, you know, having, you know, the end, like flashing back to when Wah and Nora are together, I think I was looking at the extras on the Wong Kar Wai box set, and I think there's an alternate ending on there that has a little bit more of that flashback, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. I'd kind of revel in it a little bit more, which again, that's him putting his spin on it, you know, to kind of delve into what he wants to go through, again, within the confines of the genre structure. So yeah. In that sense, I get it.
I'll have to go back and actually watch the features. I thought about watching, like, because I saw that the Criterion Channel, and maybe this is in the box set too, has the alternate version of Days of Being Wild. Yep. And I wished I would have watched them both just to kind of compare. But you know how life is. You know how time is. But I want to go back and go through all the features on the disc, because these are pretty loaded. And it'd be nice just to get another... I don't know, another, some more insight on the movie. I think with this movie, once you kind of realize that the central relationship is Wah and Fly more than it is Wah and Nor, you're able to kind of go with, like, okay, well, this is the only way this can end for these two. They are connected to each other. They are bonded. They're going to, you know, even with the separation, the one guy's not going to give up on him. So he's going to come back, and sure, you know that things are going to kind of fall apart. And sure enough, that's what happens. But yeah, I think it ends in the most fitting of fashion, even though we're all kind of cheering for Wah and Nora to just end up happily ever after. But that's not what this movie is. So I guess we can kind of wrap things up there then with this movie. Did you guys have any other thoughts about this just in general, or things you want to talk about with this movie before we kind of give it our stamp of rating?
I wanted to point out one quick thing. Like, there's an incredible shot in this movie where our heroes are kind of like getting beat up in an alleyway. And there's this, it's this very long hallway. It has to be hundreds of yards long. And like, it's a very like dark, and there's a lot of like dark blue hues in this movie for coloring. And in the background of this scene is like this one part of this alleyway that's shot with like red light. And I just think like little details like that really make the movie for me personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very specific. You might not remember it, but I watching sure. it just shot out to me.
I'll have in the next movie, I'll have a shot that really stood out to me as well. So yeah, I get it. It's just, there are little details here and there where it's like, there's something that kind of like scratches that itch for us. And mm-hmm. yeah, I'm glad to hear that there was something in here that was really like that detail oriented for you that mm-hmm. stood out. Derek, any other closing thoughts on this movie?
Not really. Again, you know, I hate to beat a dead horse, but again, it's a pretty, you know, it's certainly the most clear cut of, you know, the narratives I'm sure that we'll encounter probably in this series, because again, it is very much tied to the popular genre of the time. And, you know, again, it's all about the grace notes in between there that, you know, hearken at who this will become.
Yeah. What would you guys rate this movie? That, even though I know ratings are of course arbitrary, but still, I like to ask that question. Derek, we'll start with you. What would your rating be for As Tears Go By?
I gave it a 4 out of 5 on Letterboxd. You know, sure. Again, even though it's, you know, working with tropes, you know, it's doing a very cool job with it in terms of, you know, execution and style and action. Where I thought it was a very fulfilling experience even with that.
Yeah. Blake, your final rating on this one.
I'm also at a 4 stars. Nice. Yeah, I feel like Derek said, this is just like, there's just things here that are like the seeds of what eventually come to fruition. So, but I have to say, for a debut movie where he might not have gotten full creative control, it sure feels like he got a lot of it in this one. So
yeah, it definitely feels like he had his voice and vision, were at play here. I gave this one a 3.5, and I don't think that I liked it like less. I don't think I thought it was a bad movie at all. I think the kind of rushing into the third act is what kind of took it down for me. But man, it was really cool to get to see this movie after having seen, you know, a couple of the other Wong Kar Wai films and having so, you know, this idea of what these movies are supposed to be, and then just kind of see this to like, oh well, he has a varied sense of a varied filmography as well. So mm-hmm. pretty excited to roll forward with this, and we'll do just that with Days of Being Wild. Any initial thoughts, Blake? I'll start with you on this one. Initial thoughts on Days of Being Wild.
I want to pose a question to you guys about this.
Sure.
Did any of you guys think to yourselves that he could have switched the titles of these movies and they would have still made sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The thought definitely didn't cross my mind, but now right. that you mention it, I almost can't unsee it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I like this one a lot less than As Tears Go By. I still liked it quite a bit. This one gets more into like who Wong Kar Wai is. I just don't think his style quite meets up with what like he's accomplished in other movies. But like this is more. He's now moving into like who he is in terms of like what he wants to tell us as a voice, and his style. It just works slightly less on a visual and maybe like excitement level, even though we get like a very ravishing, I would say a more ravishing Maggie Cheung in this role than in As Tears Go By.
Derek, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, this is much more of the overall mood piece, the movie that, or of the two that we watched, this is the one where it's, you know, like more, even right from the very start, when you have our initial two characters, you know, just hanging and chilling and enjoying each other's company, you know, and for me, of course, it's a shift a little bit, you know, in terms of, okay, this is just going to be a little bit more free flowing and more interesting, like the interpersonal relationships than anything resembling a plot. Mm-hmm. But I still found it fascinating. You know, of course it does get a little bit plotty at the end, but I think nothing that necessarily distracted me in that sense.
Yeah. this might come as a surprise to you guys, but I like this one just a hair more, than the last one. I think there's, you know, I think there is a clear romantic vibe here that I was totally on with. And I mm-hmm. think that sense of like that longing and yearning is very apparent here. And I really, mm-hmm. really was riding with it. Because it's like there are people in this movie that are yearning for a romantic relationship. And then there's the central character who is... Because there is a very important relationship that was missing from his life, it feels like it has affected all of his other relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's just really like, I don't know, it really, really hit for me. What would drop down my ultimate rating of this movie is the kind of crime scene mm-hmm. at the end where it's just like, wait a second, that's not the movie I was watching. Why mm-hmm. why are we doing this? But overall, I quite like this one, and I think this is what I am excited for to kind of continue on this journey, like for more movies that harness what this movie did and make it even stronger. As the rest of the filmography will kind of reveal. But yeah, I really enjoyed this one. I was again, as we said earlier, Maggie Cheung is just absolutely ravishing in this movie. Like, just wow. And it's like, I'm trying to think of a way to say this. Like, it's not like she's done up in a way where she's like this she seems like just a regular person, like a normal everyday you know, person who goes to a job every day, but there's just something about the way that Kar Wai films her, Wong Kar Wai films her, that it's like, we're supposed to fall in love with her. So I don't know. I don't know. That's just my thoughts, but we can kind of break this movie apart and, you know, talk about it as we go.
All right. So we start off with our main, first off, this movie takes place in the early 1960s. This is a period piece. Our main character is Yeti, played by Leslie Cheung. He's a bit of this slick, smooth playboy type character, you know, kind of goes on, you know, from one girlfriend to the other. The first 10 minutes is basically him courting this Maggie Cheung character of Li Shen, who's running basically like this concession stand or storefront, and he kind of like passes by her every day. At least that's how I gauged it. So the first 10 minutes are basically just them spending, you know, time together, you know, but of course Yeti doesn't really want to commit to any more of like a serious relationship, even though Li Zhen kind of wants to get married. So she breaks it off, she leaves him, and that's where that breaks, even though she will continue to be a part of this movie, even though they're not necessarily in a relationship together. One of the big conceits of this movie is that Yeti, Yeti knows that he is not, that he was adopted. Her stepmom is kind of like this, you know, like bitter personality, or they've had this conflict or whatever, because his stepmom does not want to reveal to him who his mother is, even though of course he is naturally very curious. There will be some developments later in this movie on that front, but there's a little bit of conflict in the stepmom-son relationship because of that. Other characters include Yeti's next girlfriend, which is Mimi, a cabaret dancer. And she is played by Karina Lau. We also have Yeti's best friend, Zeb. Once again, Jackie Chung in the best friend role. He's a little bit more meek this time. He has a little bit of a crush on Mimi. Always throws out hints, but of course Mimi doesn't take the bait. And then we also have this policeman character, Tide, who is played by Andy Lau. We basically introduce him because he does his rounds near where Yeti lives, and there becomes all this interaction between Tide and Li Zhen. Tide is a policeman, but he wants to become a sailor. Put a pin in that, because that'll come in very handy later. And Li Zhen kind of uses Tide as a sounding board, you know, because they just kind of chat in the street. And there's this whole motif about, you know, calling him on the phone, you know, if they ever need to talk. Ultimately, Tide's mom passed away, and Tide leads to become a sailor. Again, put a pin in that, because that'll come in very handy later. So I'll stop there, but that basically is the gist of all the characters that we're following in this movie.
Yeah. Again, it's table setting. You get to, you know, meet the characters, kind of learn what they're about, learn what their connection is. And I think this one is interesting because it feels like you start off with one character and then they slowly absorb the other ones. Like the relationships kind of like naturally connect. I don't know. I can think of it in my head of how I'm trying to describe this, but it's like not every character is there right from the start. The relationships are not all already established. You kind of get to go along and pick up people along the way. And I kind of like the way that this movie does that. This movie gets those relationships started. It shows those beginning, those initial connections. And I really, I don't know, I was really hooked into this, just kind of wanting to know more about these characters, where they came from. And I think because of the way that, I don't know, this is probably just me, but the way that you're kind of connected to Maggie Cheung and Li Zhen, you feel bad when this guy, this player, just kind of like drops her. She's the one who does the breaking up, but you can tell that he's very much at a distance with all this. He doesn't want to connect to her as any more than just just a friend that he gets to spend some time with and do stuff with. But then, you know, he meets Mimi, and Mimi is just this, I don't know, a whole completely different person than Li Zhen is. And you kind of feel this a little bit of bitterness towards her, but also like, you know, okay, maybe this girl is more of his, style, because he's detached from other people, and maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. Just kind of talking through things. I'm also watching a lot of the reality TV show Love Island while I'm watching these movies. And so my kind of like connection to relationships has been very much like, oh God, these people. And then it's like kind of watching it in the movie, it's like, oh, these people, I root for you, I don't root for you. So I don't know. It's weird, the influences that we have. Blake, your thoughts on this section of the movie?
Yeah, how do I say this? I really dug the stuff where, like, I forget the character's name, but where, like, the main character, he walks in and he's just like, you're gonna dream about me tonight, and then like tomorrow you're gonna be thinking about me, it's little things like that Wong Kar-wai does, where he talks about how, like, what does he say? He says something like, on this day at this time, we shared this minute together, and you're never going to forget that minute. And like, that's the stuff that like Wong Kar-wai does later in movies, where like characters pontificate on like the love with like these weird ways of actually remembering them. Like, I don't want to spoil too much, but like in Chungking Express, like one character is obsessed with like cans of pineapple on a specific date, and like it's just weird things like that that he does, that like he's able to make these people like lust over others based on like these little ideas in their heads on specific dates and specific times. And that's the stuff that I love. Another thing, I love the sequence where Maggie Cheung and the cop are just walking through the streets talking. Like, that's this, like, it reminded me a lot of like Before Sunrise, I think it's the first one. Like, stuff like that. Like, I really got into like the things like that. And you also get a sense of that this guy, like, while he treats these women like crap, and it kind of sucks that he does, you get the you at least understand why he does it. You know, like, he's been left by his mother, and he doesn't know why, he doesn't know who she is, and you know, you kind of have a little bit of empathy for him in that respect. And I have to admit, I was kind of like I was a little bored with this section of the movie, because I was kind of like wondering where the pieces were going to add up. And thankfully, you kind of get that later on in the movie.
Derek, any thoughts on the section that you reviewed for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Blake just said there last is certainly what I was looking through to get latch on, because, you know, before I popped in the movie, you know, the plot synopsis really play up the whole thing about like, yep, this guy learns he is adopted. And, you know, and that kind of becomes, you know, the closest thing to, well, outside of the crime stuff, the closest thing to a plot in this movie, as we'll get into in the second half. And, you know, I think this is to what you were pointing out, Eddie, in terms of like, you know, because of that, you know, rift, you know, and not having, you know, a true mother-son relationship, how that informs everything else, or how he treats women, you know, as a result of that. And it, you know, it's, you know, it is a bit of a shift in there. And of course, ultimately the second half is where it kind of clicks up, because that's what ultimately gives the movie, you know, a momentum and a bit of a, you know, a true literal character journey as a result of that.
I agree. And we'll kind of talk about that as we go along here, because I have some thoughts on the whole search for a mother scene. So let's go ahead and continue with the plot of the movie.
Yeah, so the way this kind of kicks off is, so Yeti's stepmom, she has a new suitor, and if I recall correctly, they're going to go off to America. And so it's kind of like one last parting thing, you know, one last parting thing before she leaves for America. She finally informs Yeti, okay, your birth mother is in the Philippines. And so this gives Yeti the momentum to, you know, fully embark on that journey. He basically, let's see here. So knowing that he's going to take off, he gives his car to Zeb. He also doesn't tell Mimi, his current cabaret singer girlfriend, that he's taking off. And because of that, she's decided, you know, she's heartbroken that, you know, he took off without saying anything. So, of course, she's going to head off to the Philippines, too, to find him. And so when Mimi comes to Zeb, like, where's Yeti? And she tells Zeb that, you know, she's going to go to the Philippines, too. So Zeb sells off Yeti's car and gives the money to her, you know, to help fund her trip as well. Ultimately, it's a very brief sequence where Yeti goes to, you know, the seemingly spacious estate where his birth mother lives. But of course, he knocks on the door, servant shows up, you know, his mother isn't even going to meet him face to face on that. And so he carts off, he gets upset, he gets drunk, and this is where our newly sailored tide intersects, and these two come back together. And basically Tide takes Yeti off of the street, brings him up to his hotel room, and of course, you know, tries to help him out, you know, since his journey has kind of been all for naught at this point. And this is where we get into the crime stuff. Because they're now trying to get Yeti American passport, you know, so he can take off. And so we get this little back room encounter at the train station. Suffice to say, things don't go very well. Yeti ends up stabbing the guy because he doesn't have money for the passport. Yeti and Ty then run off. You know, we get this big elaborate action sequence at the train station. But of course, ultimately he doesn't work out. This is where we get to where Blake was talking about, where we had the little thing early on about Yeti talking to Li Jun about, you know, remember this particular moment at this particular day and so forth. And this comes up on a conversation between Tide and Yeti on the train, because obviously Tide or Li Zhen had told Tide about this whole thing back when they were talking together. And ultimately Yeti does say yes, that he does remember that conversation. But ultimately Ty departs from his seat for a little bit. When he comes back, Yeti's been shot to death. Then we get a little bit of a montage at the end where Mimi has indeed showed up in the Philippines looking for Yeti. Li Zhen is working at like this ticket booth. The phone booth that was talked about earlier on the street by Yeti's house is ringing. And then the very final scene is of a person we have not met up until this point, played by Tony Leung, who's like getting ready to go out. And the trivia with this is that this is actually supposed to be a sequel to this movie that did not manifest, because this movie was kind of a bomb when it came out, because people were kind of expecting another As Tears Go By, and they didn't get that, and they kind of revolted. So... in fact, I was reading a comment in the booklet in the Wong Kar-wai book that when Shanghai audiences saw this movie, they like stuck outraged viewers slashed the cinema seats in Singapore, which indicates the reaction to this movie. Although it did go on to be critically acclaimed and won a lot of awards and kind of set the course for Wong Kar-wai's career. So there you go.
Yeah. A lot going on in this back half of the movie. I think maybe before I dive into it, Blake, what are some of your thoughts on this this last section?
I really dug, like, a lot of my thoughts are more aesthetic stuff than actual plot things, because I don't really connect with some of the plot stuff. I love Wong Kar-wai for the visual stuff, but this is sort of like there's like a Steadicam shot in this that goes through like upstairs and and I thought that stood out, because most of the time he's just a guy who's like shaking the camera everywhere, and that was a really cool shot. And like Derek's, like you guys said, this is where the crime comes in, and this is where it kind of becomes like something else, almost like this is where it feels like maybe like a producer was like, yeah, where's the crime stuff from the first movie you did? So it sort of feels like shoehorned in here. And I you know, like I love like a lot of the quiet scenes with Maggie Cheung at the end. I thought there was going to be like some sort of like reconnection or something, but we just kind of just got her at the end in this football stadium, sort of like, she's just kind of on her own now. And as Derek talked about, the Tony Leung sequence is just sort of like, that's like my bread and butter for Wong Kar Wai, that like whole sequence there where you just meet this guy we've never met before, he's getting ready to go out, and then it's just the movie just ends. I love stuff like that. I really love the ambiguity of that. And you know, reading about how like he's just sort of like the next guy in line to go out and womanize, like he's just the next guy. I thought that was really cool way to end it as sort of like ambiguous and esoteric. I loved that ending. So yeah.
Interesting. I'll talk about the ending here in a second because I'll get to that. What I want to talk about first is I want to talk about the argument scene between Mimi and Li Zhen. I loved that sequence. I thought that was great. There's a scene in there where Mimi confronts Li Zhen when she can't find where Yeti went. And she says, is he back with you? Like, you know, and she's there to kind of brag that no, now he's mine, but now he's gone. And so she cries. And then it feels like Li Zhen kind of gets her validation. I'm over him. That was in the past. Yes, he left me, but yeah, I'm done. And then Mimi still tries to, you know, say, hey, well, he just so you know, he left you for me. And then she's like, well, yeah, but look who's the one left crying now. I was just like, this is great. Like, it's just, and it's filmed in such a way too. Like everything about that scene pops for me. The two actors, the way that it's filmed, the dialogue, like that is,
yeah,
that is my jam. Like you said, that the ending scene is your kind of jam, but watching these two characters have this moment together, like I was locked in, and I wanted to kind of let that linger for a bit. But
I really love the way like she comes screaming in and Maggie Cheung just goes like, oh, he left you too, huh? just like
completely disarms her.
Yeah.
With facts.
So good.
Just great. The other other sequence I want to talk about is Mimi going to Zeb to find out where Yeti went. So she, you know, she goes into, was it a club or something where Zeb was? Because I guess she saw Yeti's car. But she goes into this room and she's like, oh, it's just you. You know, I was looking for Yeti. And he's like, yeah, Yeti left for the Philippines. You know, I have his car now. And she just sits, stands there calmly, like goes into the room, stands there super calmly, and then like turns and throws everything off the table. And it was just like, man, this woman is volatile. Like this is an angry, like explosive, like she is pissed off at this situation. And I felt it was really interesting because when they first connected, there felt like, it felt like they were both so like doing a dance. They were both kind of like entertaining the relationship, but both kind of keeping her distance. And then Mimi, of course, lets her guard down first when she doesn't leave, when he tells her to leave the apartment and never, and it, you know, if she leaves the apartment, she can never come back. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't leave. She instead pulls up a chair and sits next to the bed. Like, fine, I'm not going to sleep here, but I'm sitting here. I'm not going anywhere. But now, you know, by the point that he's left, like she is just furious. And felt this connection that was just kind of ended. So then when she leaves, Zeb, who has had this kind of crush on her the whole time, follows behind her in his car, and she like, you know, walks over to the car and pulls the door open, like, why are you following me? And they have this conversation, and then like they're just angry and grabbing each other, and then like Zeb slaps her, like just like two pops, and she just falls to the ground, and it's like He's done. He feels upset. But of course, he still, in the end, you know, sells the car, gives her the money because he feels bad for what happened, wants to make sure that she is able to meet up with Yeti in the Philippines. And, you know, then, of course, that doesn't happen because crime plot line. I loved the shot leading from the street upstairs into the train station. Like that tracking shot was just or Steadicam shot was just exquisite. Like, it was so fun to kind of see movement because all of this movie felt so static. And then to kind of have this moment where it feels like we're really experiencing this movement, like, that really stood out to me. And then, yeah, we get the crime scene and the death scene that just feels exactly like you said, Blake. Like, some producer was like, wait a second, we need conflict here. You gave us a crime movie last time, we're gonna need that again. And so he's like, oh, okay, we're gonna kill him at the end, and then there we go. And then, yeah, the last shot of this movie, great to see Tony Leung, just always great to see him. But I'm not, I think your explanation of it, Blake, was something that really, I was like, oh, well, okay. If that's the vibe they're going for, I kind of get it, but it's like, it still doesn't connect for me. And I think that's why my score kind of lowered a little bit, was because it was like, oh, this is so out there. We're just having a whole nother character here that, you know, I don't know where this guy came from. I don't know what his purpose is, but I think you're right that he's the next guy who's going to have those days of being wild.
Yeah. I also read that this is like sort of like first in like an unofficial trilogy with In the Mood for Love and 2046, that Tony Leung is playing that same guy. So we can get to that at a later date, but I thought that was an interesting theory as well.
Yeah, and it may very well be that we're getting our first taste of that character as he prepares to go on about his life. But yeah, I read that same thing where this is, you know, part of an unofficial trilogy, an informal trilogy, of those three movies. So, Derek, any last thoughts on this section of the movie, or thoughts on the movie in general?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as I mentioned, even though the plot kind of really kicks in here, both for good and for bad, in the second half, I guess what appealed to me more is just kind of seeing how these movies come with this, all these different combinations of characters interacting with each other, even if it's a little bit more stretched, like, oh, here conveniently is Sailor Tide here to help things out. But why the heck not? I mean, this is a movie where people are kind of drifting in and out with each other anyway. Yeah. So I was pretty much in favor with that. That wasn't an issue with me necessarily. Again, it's a little bit, you know, the way that, you know, kind of like the action or kind of like the brawl in the train station kind of comes up almost suddenly. You know, it's jarring, but at the same time, I don't think it complete, you know, I don't think it completely derailed the experience for me as much as it did for you, Andy. I'm fine with that. Yeah. But again, you know, again, it's mostly just, you know, seeing, you know, how these characters connect with each other. That's the greater appeal of the movie to me, more so than anything related with the plot momentum, as it were. So,
I think the one thing that may have made the ending a little more powerful, but just more honest, real, is if there had been some indication before, and maybe I missed it, some indication before that Yeti had like some kind of connection to crime, like he had done unlawful things in the past. And I know that, you know, his stepmother essentially a prostitute or had been a prostitute, and that's some tie to crime. But I wish that if there had been a little bit more there, that ending wouldn't have felt such an abrupt turn for me. But
did he have
I liked it.
Did he have a gun earlier in the movie?
I don't remember.
I just feel like out of nowhere he has a gun, and like there's these shooting people, and I'm like, what is going on here? Like,
well, I think
what movie is this?
I know. I feel like he took somebody's gun. I never saw him, but that's what my, that was like the dots that my mind connected was like, oh, he must have taken somebody's gun there. He must have stabbed somebody and taken their gun from them. But
that's fair.
It's such a yeah, it was a weird click for me, but overall, I get it. The one thing I didn't talk about that I said I was going to was the scene of him finally finding his mother in the Philippines. Man, for IMDb to kind of use that as the plot synopsis with him actually, like, his journey to see his mother lasts like a minute, two minutes long. Yeah. Yep. Like, goodness gracious. Like, there's a lot of other stuff going on here. And then this is such a non-event. I mean, yeah, it's an event because it's a part of his life, but man, like, the devastation there, I can understand his decline.
I think that's my problem with the movie. It isn't the movie itself. It's the fact that I was led to believe that the main plot of this movie was, like, this guy finds out that it's, like, he wants to know who his mom is. Or yeah. I think what I read was, like, he finds out that the woman taking care of him is not his mother. But, yeah, like, that
information... That happens off screen.
That happens before the movie even starts.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, so I think I was waiting for, like, that character change to happen, and it already happened. So, like, I think that's what's really throwing me off with this movie, is that we were led to believe something else when, like, that happens already. That's, like, the information you're given before you start.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, you know. Maybe it's not fair to the movie that I rated it so low, but...
No, I get it. I think when you're expecting one thing and there's kind of a disconnect there, it's hard to kind of be like, well, no, I can't rate it based on what my expectations are going to be.
Yeah.
I have to rate it on what it is. But yet sometimes it's hard to do that. Cause I think that's how I felt towards the first one, because I was expecting a quote unquote Wong Kar Wai movie from what I had, you know, been used to. And that one was so different. That it didn't quite land as strongly for me as this one did, because I felt there was certainly that vibe there, even though this takes a weird detour at the end. But I don't know, just thoughts. Speaking of thoughts, any closing thoughts from either of you guys on this movie?
No.
I did just find one interesting piece of trivia, is that there was a parody movie of this made in Hong Kong in 92 called The Days of Being Dumb, which also has Tony Leung in it and Jackie Chung in it, surprisingly.
Interesting.
So just had to throw that out there.
Yeah,
it looks hardly very connected, but still.
Right? I saw that when I was looking at the Wikipedia page, and I was like, what is this? I'm going to have to, I don't know if I'm going to be able to track that down and find it, but what exactly did they do in that movie? So, let's talk ratings. I can't remember who I started with last time, so I'll start with Derek. Derek, yeah. what would you rate Days of Being Wild?
I kind of vacillated between a 3.5 and a 4, and I think I ultimately landed on a 4 because, you know, again, at least for me in this journey, to kind of see, like, okay, this is kind of the basis, you know, for, you know, what, you know, the tone and tenor of these other movies will be. And I could get on vibe. I got on the vibe with this. It worked for me enough to get to that point. So I'll be very curious to see where things fall out from here with the next movies that we watch.
Yeah. Blake, what were your, what was your rating for this one?
I think I gave it a 3.
Sure.
And the more we talk about it and think about it, the more I think about images from the movie. With I think I'm going to bump it up to a 3.5.
Okay. Yeah. I'm at a 3.5 as well. I kind of thought about a 4 too, but for me the ending, that kind of out of nowhere crime section, just really, while it was well done and while I enjoyed it, it still was like, this feels shoehorned in here, and it doesn't quite sit well with me, but that's okay. I still like this one just a little bit more than As Tears Go By, and it makes me very excited for our next movie. So I'll we'll do this on air. Why not do it on air? Are we doing, for our next episode, are we doing the next two films in the series, or are we doing the next three films?
I guess I was thinking the next two, because I think we're going to have a lot to say about Chungking Express. Sure. So
yeah,
I think that would be the easiest.
I think it's best to have just those two, since Fallen Angels was supposed to be. So without getting too spoilery, Chungking Express is two separate stories.
Okay.
For its movie, and Fallen Angels is like was a planned third one that he just moved to its own movie.
Okay.
So I think it's just best to have those two movies on one episode.
Perfect. That works. That works for me. And that'll come up next month, at the end of next month. But we will still have another Criterion break before then, because guys, we're going to talk about the Oscars. I think this has been a really good year for movies, and I think we all have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good place for us to kind of express reflect. Our last minute's thought. Yeah, reflect our on our last minute thoughts before before Oscar night. So our next episode will be in a couple of weeks, and we will talk about the 2022-2023 Oscar nominations. I don't know where I'm at these days. Yeah. I don't know what year it is. But yeah, it'll be fun to kind of chat with you guys on air about these things that we have been talking about over the course of the last year to kind of lead up to actual Oscar night. So it'll be fun to get it on record as we mm-hmm. talk about the Oscars and where that, you know, where that is Criterion related and where it isn't, because I think there are some movies that are not Criterion going to be part of the Criterion collection that'll be nice to have a chance to chat about on record. So I guess, do you guys have any closing thoughts before we do our promotions and plugs?
I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode of the Criterion Break. Blake, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Letterboxd. The Real John G is my username. I review everything that I watch. And then in person, you can find me at the State Theater working every once in a while. Come say hi. Yeah, I think that's it.
Awesome. Derek, where can people find you online?
Yeah, you can find me on the Letterboxd as well. My username is D-E-R-V Dude. That's Derv Dude. You can find me on the Instagram at the same username. You can find me on the Facebook as well. You can also find me at the State Theater. I'm not an employee. I just go there all the time. And who knows? I might be berating Blake when you get there. You get a tour.
I work there and Derek is there more than I am.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. You can follow all things Fat Dude Digs Flicks on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, even TikTok. Just do a search for Fat Dude Digs Flicks and you will find me there. Subscribe to this podcast. Like this podcast. Rate and review this podcast. Share this podcast with your friends. We're going to keep doing this just because, or at least until we don't enjoy it anymore. But we would love to have more listeners. And the best way to do that is with your help. So please share this podcast with people that would be interested in it. And also leave us a rating and a review because that helps as well, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you do subscribe to this podcast, not only will you get the Criterion Break, but you will also get Let's Talk About, which is an interview show where I am joined by a guest. We chat about their life, their passions, and a movie that is a very important movie to them. Sometimes we talk way more about their life than we do the movie, and that is by design, because sometimes I just find people very interesting and I want to pump them up a bit. So, but anyway, we eventually get to talk about movies in there, so you'll want to subscribe so you can enjoy that as well. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, recommendations, or would like to be a guest on the show, please send an email to fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. Always looking for more guests, always looking for recommendations on things to cover. If you are in the Sioux Falls, or if you're in the South Dakota area in general, subscribe to South Dakota Film Community Group. I was so close. South Dakota Film Community Group on Facebook. Join in the conversation there. Even if you're not in South Dakota and just want to talk to people about movies, that is a good place to do so. Am I missing anything? I don't think so. I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it. Anybody have a special goodbye already planned? Is that it? You've been listening to The Criterion Break. Thank you for listening to Fat Dude Digs Flicks.